RadioInfluence.com. You are sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence.
Welcome to another episode of Sitting Ringside. My name is David Penzer, and we are so glad that you are here once again to listen to this thing we call a podcast each and every week. We drop Monday mornings, and we appreciate you listening. As always, want to let you know to please subscribe if you haven't already. Tell your friends and neighbors, too, as well. And any feedback is awesome. At David Penzer on Twitter, all one word, or at Penzer Ringside is the Twitter site of the show. So that's the official Twitter site of the show. Want to let you know that coming up here in just a little bit, we're going to talk to the one and only Simon Diamond. He's a hilarious guy, and we'll tell some stories and find out about his career, what he's doing now. But I wanted to bring off right up the top. I apologized last week, but I figured if I'm going to be a man about it, I have to do it not to his face, but do it to him at least, quote unquote, in person. So Mike Freeland, the associate producer of this podcast, welcome to Sitting Ringside, man.
David, it feels good to be back. It feels fantastic. But it even feels better when the stars align and you realize that the Freeland fanatics are truly out there.
There's like three. But hey. There are three, though. That's the that's the amazing part. So listen. So I was wrong. I accused you of having somebody, a friend or a family member, write that review. And it turned out that was not the case, apparently. So I do apologize. I said I would apologize. So,
No harm, no foul, David. No harm, no foul whatsoever. See, I felt very confident in myself. I was very excited that people were enjoying the show, which a lot of people do. But I was very grateful that our good friend Trademark MMA, another shout out to him, filled out that awesome iTunes review and had some very nice words to say about the show.
Yeah, for some reason he likes you. I still can't figure that one out, but I appreciate him as a listener. So I wanted to know if you watched the much-anticipated 30 for 30 special on Ric Flair, and I'm asking you. Yeah, of course you did. That's like asking a Hillary Clinton fan if they watched Rachel Maddow last night. But not to be mean. I'm just, you know, I'm just making an analogy. That's it. I love Rachel Maddow. Great woman. Personal friend, actually. But no, just kidding. But so I'm assuming that you watched it, and I'm wondering what you thought, because as somebody who's a longtime fan and a huge Ric Flair fan, I'm wondering what you thought, because I lived it. I mean, there's nothing that was in there that surprised me. It surprised me that certain people said it out loud and that they aired it, but nothing in there that surprised me as far as that goes. So I'm wondering, as a fan, what were your thoughts?
I love the candidness that that Rick spoke with. You know, I loved obviously hearing, and I have obviously known his career for a long time as far as, you know, where he had gone, the promotions, the territories. But I think the part that at least hit with me really hard was the personal life. You know, to hear his kids talk on camera, for him to openly admit, you know, he just wasn't home all the time. And You know that happens with wrestlers a lot. You know, they talk about being on the road 300 days a year, and they're just not around. It's just the nature of the line of work they're in. But to hear his kids speak and to hear about, you know, he was bored being home. He would head over to another wrestler's house to hang out for a while. But just to hear the family side of it, to hear the humanistic side of it, and to finally hear that the Ric Flair persona, it really became too much for him to walk away from. I mean, you know, the family life in some ways wasn't for him in the early going. So I love the human interest side of it. But Rick's a candid guy. I mean, you know him probably just as well as anybody. But I loved it. I loved it. I don't know if I could necessarily pick out one aspect that I liked the best about it. But I think overall it was such a well done piece, and I think it was really neat that they did two-part interview with him, meaning interview him in a one time, and then 16 months later they went ahead and they did a second interview with him. So I loved it. I have nothing to bark about, and all the emotion was in there. Did you feel that as well, that it wasn't just a story, but it was this person's life that they had lived, and all these people around them were there because they had shared moments with him?
Yeah, I mean, Rick's an emotional guy. We all know that. And, you know, Rick is far from perfect, as he said himself. And that's the part that I wonder as a fan. Of course, with social media and the internet, you know, fans know way more now than they did back, you know, in the 80s and 90s. But I'm wondering, as a fan, you know, somebody who walked down the aisle of their wedding wanting to wear a Ric Flair robe with belts, and we're not going to relive that. But I'm just trying to point out that that's how much of a fan you were. I'm wondering if it disappointed you that he's a real person with some real big flaws.
I mean, I think when you look at that side of it, you know, going into it, that you're right. No one's perfect. And that he can admit to that as well. Were there some aspects that I kind of was like, I don't know if I necessarily align myself with as far as family values and whatnot? Yeah, of course. Absolutely. When it came to the topic of monogamy, you know, I kind of cringed a little bit, but once again, he lives his life the way he does. I live the life the way I do. Just because you don't see eye to eye on every necessarily moral stance, it doesn't mean that you can't still respect people. As far as I'm concerned, I don't see anybody that Rick has gone out of his way to hurt, if that makes sense. I know things might not have always worked out relationship wise, but it never feels like people are outwardly angry towards him. Does that make sense? I really feel like everybody kind of, for the most part, is just, that's Rick.
I think that they did for a long time. I think as he got into his 60s and got older and he still continued with the shenanigans, I think that a lot of people, I know that a lot of people started rolling their eyes. There's, you know, there's a time in someone's life where they have to sort of be, you know, stop being a character and you know, move to the next phase of your life. And I think until he almost died, quite frankly, I don't think he was able to do that. And I think that it turned a lot of people that used to be friends with him off, you know, because he's Ric Flair. I don't think that, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, would say that to his face. But look, I was shocked that Jim Ross said, which I knew by traveling with the guy, that he always had to be the face of attention. Like he said, he'd walk into a bar with 10 people he didn't know, and instead of just being able to have a drink with Jim Ross and have a conversation, go to bed, he needed to throw a party because, you know, that's why he lost millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I'm not exaggerating any more than he's exaggerating when he says 10,000 women.
Right.
You know, I looked at that number, and then I started remembering, you know, things. And then I took out my calculator. I actually paused it and I took out my calculator and I'm going, all right, this many days on the road times this many years in the business. And it came out to, like, you know, right around 10,000. So he might've exaggerated a little bit, but I would say that 7,500 is not an exaggeration. 8,000, not an exaggeration, but, you know, he also was the kind of guy, and what I was saying is he lost millions of dollars by picking up bar tabs because he had to be the center of attention, and he was Ric Flair. He didn't need to do that. He was the center of attention anyway, but in his mind, it wasn't enough. And the fact that Jim Ross said that, which is something that I've known and people in the business have known, but nobody's really said out loud, I thought was stunning. Also, the fact that Triple H, you know, basically said he's a liar and he'll say anything, you know, that he can to get you to do what he wants you to do. I thought that was a little stiff, quite frankly, but I don't know Rick as well as Triple H does. So, you know, and I have not dealt with Rick as being a boss. So, you know, Triple H would know more in that vein, but I was surprised that those things were said, and that, you know, anybody that said that Ric Flair, you know, had any, veto power on what was said, I would think he would not be, not that he wouldn't, that he'd be unhappy that those things were said, but, you know, it's going to be, you know, you think that was the last of when he did those interviews, of him being introspective? He's going to watch that. And he's going to go, oh, my God, look at what all these people said about me. And he's going to have to do some introspective soul searching because, you know, you can't be Ric Flair at 80 years old. And, you know, I hope that, you know, he stays off, the alcohol. And I had no idea, by the way, that towards the end, last 10, 15, 20 years, you know, after he retired, he was, you know, drinking at 10 a.m. You know, I'd see him at a bar at around, you know, if he did a Legends of Wrestling show or a TNA show, you know, 8, 9 at night, you know, have a couple drinks, go to bed. He was going to bed earlier. I knew that. I just thought that was getting older. But now I know it was because he had been drinking all day, which I did not know. So that one surprised me a little bit. I had heard that in the preview. So, yeah, a very unique individual. It's funny if he would have, and I'm glad he didn't. You know, we all prayed for him, and we sent our prayers when he was in the hospital when we first started this show, first few weeks. But when he was going through his ordeal, but it's almost like if he had like died at 50, he'd have been like James Dean or Elvis Presley. But you know,
absolutely.
You don't know how those guys would have endured. At 67, 68, 75, how do those guys endure it? How could you be Elvis at 75? How could you be, you know, that's the reason why they don't do Rocky movies anymore. You can't be Rocky at, they tried it, but, you know, it was the, you know, different ways of getting other characters over with using Rocky, you know, as like a guide almost. But, you know, you can't live. About the only one who's come as close to being able to live their gimmick as long as they have, it's pretty ironic, is Hulk. But Hulk doesn't live his gimmick. Hulk is a totally different guy unless you turn on a camera and a microphone, right, and tell him to be Hulk Hogan. But he still looks like Hulk Hogan. He could still, you know, cut the promo like Hulk Hogan, you know, other than a little bit of bad press that he got, or a lot of bad press that he got for a couple stupid things he said at the lowest point of his life. Pretty much successful and beloved. So, Hulk Hogan is still Hulk Hogan at, you know, 65, 60, whatever he is. But, it's hard to continue that. I think The Rock will still be The Rock when he's 75 years old. I just saw his father at the fan fest we did a couple of weeks ago. And I know he's working on some projects with Rocky. A little inside news. But,
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
What would you say, what is the difference, David, when a character, and you've been around some of the biggest ones of all time, what's the difference between those who know how to turn it off and those who don't? Like, is there something that you can say definitively is different about that person? Meaning, you gave an example of Hulk Hogan. Well, of course, Hulk Hogan is him on camera, but he's Terry when you guys maybe are at a restaurant or you're doing whatever. You're just Terry talking, two fathers talking about kids, as opposed to maybe Rick, where Rick has to be Nate all the time, 24/7. What do you feel like is that? Okay, this is the difference between these two. Do you think maybe the upbringing, maybe he felt like he was never loved enough, so he needed to create this alter ego? Maybe it's, you know, a little bit of insecurities, or what would you say is the main difference between those two guys since you brought them up?
You know, I don't know a lot about Hulk's upbringing as a child. They did the whole Sigmund Freud thing on, you know, where his parents, you know, didn't show up and only saw three of his matches and didn't show up at his sports events, and did that make him how he is? And who knows? I mean, there's a lot of things that go into how somebody, you know, lives their life. And part of it is their upbringing, for sure. But, you know, you don't know that if his parents were at every event, he still wouldn't have the insecurities that he had. And the answer to your question is Hulk Hogan is secure in being Terry Bollea. Richard Flair is not secure in being Richard Flair.
Right.
And I hope he is now. And I hope he could, you know, I hope that, you know, having a 20% chance to live and being in ICU changes his perspective on life. But, you know, and I really do hope that, but, you know, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. And I believe that he'll stay off the booze. That I believe. A lot of people don't, but I believe that. But I think it scared him that much. And I don't think Wendy will, his wife will allow that, even if he tries. But You know, it's still hard not to be Ric Flair 24/7, and it's still hard not to crave that attention. All of a sudden, that craving for attention doesn't go away. But and I'm not I don't want to be negative on Rick. Rick is one of the best wrestlers of all time, one of the greatest characters of all time. I thought it was really cool when they showed the, you know, all the different sports teams and sports figures in modern day that still quote Ric Flair's promos.
Yes,
and, you know. So I mean, you know, he brought a lot of good out there. And you know, and when you have your life examined up close. There's always going to be some negatives. Nobody's perfect, and especially when you're in the spotlight, you know, you see these days. You know, we live in times where there's a new scandal almost every day, and sometimes multiple scandals on multiple days in Hollywood and the entertainment industry, and you know, a lot of power. People that have power get filled with get taken over by that power, and people will do anything that they want and say, and they, you know, or if they won't, you could have enough money to get them to buy it. So, you know, we live in strange times when a lot of people's lives are coming back to haunt them a little bit. So, you know, if that's the worst that Ric Flair, you know, did was needing a little you know, attention and drinking a little bit too much, I would say that there's people like Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby, and the list goes on and on, grows daily, that that you know, have a lot more negative energy strewing around them than Ric Flair. So,
what do you think the headlines would be if the internet and Twitter and Facebook were around when Ric Flair was in his heyday? I mean, can you believe the videos, the pictures, the snapshots, the headlines that would just be circulating with, you know, how much of a playboy he is? I mean, because I mean, seriously, the way they depicted him right here, I mean, he lived the gimmick, but that was his life. And I'm just saying, we would hear a lot more. But I guess, you know, you're kind of you're, I don't want to say a victim of the time that you live in, but at least for Rick, the instant social media was not around back then.
They couldn't, you know, I talk to people all the time and we say, you know, could you imagine back in the day, you know, they had Twitter and social media, and it'd just be it's a totally different life now.
Absolutely.
You know, and they mentioned this several times. Rick liked to take his clothes off and get his robe on, and then the robe came off and all he had was the socks and the shoes. And well, my wife saw it in a lobby bar at a hotel on an England tour. So, I mean, you know. You know, she's sitting at the bar with me and we're all hanging out, and, you know, the pants go down you know, it is what it is. And, at least he could pull it off down there. Let's just say that, because, there's some people, you know, myself included, who, if I'm being honest, did that once and, got laughed out of the business, quite frankly. So, he could
pull. I'm no genetic freak myself either, but I mean, that takes a lot of guts. Yeah.
See, I'm hanging around with you, Mike, and now I'm too much in for a little TMI on my own.
See, but you're talking about, look at that, Dave. It's good. We're good for each other, man.
I don't know about that. But anyway, yes. But yeah, he could pull that off, but he couldn't pull that off in this day and age with cameras going and with, and people taking pictures and stuff like that. You know, it'd be, you know, it's just a different world we live in. So, you know, a lot of things are different in this social media Twitter verse that we live in. And, you know, most of them aren't good.
No, I agree. I agree 100% on that.
You know, my wife once said social media is the Antichrist. And I don't know if she was kidding around or talking tongue in cheek, but I don't know. I see such hateful, horrible things on social media, especially Twitter, where you could be anonymous. It's really sad, quite frankly. I don't want to get in a whole long thing about because we got a lot to do with Simon Diamond, and we're going to bring Shark Boy in and have some fun with him. But so I don't want to go on and on. We could do a tangent on Twitter, you know, anytime. And I don't even know that this show is the right place to do it. But it's just I think you should not be able to hide under a made up name and be able to spew, you know,
hate,
negativity and hate. And, you know, look, I agree. Anybody that knows me knows I'm not, you know, I'm all for, you know, getting rid of this PC environment we live in. You know, I'm a Merry Christmas guy and not a Happy Holidays guy. And I err on the side of being politically correct isn't the worst thing in the world. But, you know, you're dealing with, you know, people saying horrible things, you know, death threats and, you know, to reporters because you don't like their stance. Look, hey, I'm not a big fan of the media most of the time, but why would I go on there anonymously and threaten somebody, you know, make somebody who need a bodyguard or move or Secret Service? I just don't get it. It's actually scary. So that's the end of the tangent on Twitter. But
I did have one thing I want to bring up just really quickly here is I did put a poll up on the Twitter machine about whether or not the listeners of Sitting Ringside with David Penzer thought that Mike Freeland was whipped.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I felt
you didn't set any records with that response.
No, I didn't. My God. I feel like you, Jerry, and I don't know, maybe you guys got a few other people. I was looking for a little bit larger sample size. So I don't necessarily know if we can take this so much, but I got a victory with the trademark MMA. Little plug for him. But you got a victory. Allegedly, a few people had weighed in on the vote, and 75% said that they thought I was whipped. Yes, so,
because you are. There's no doubt about it.
What is your definition of whipped, though?
There's no doubt about it.
I'm just a nice guy.
Who runs the house?
Megan does.
Okay. Do you ever – I don't have to say anymore. And that's okay. It's okay. You're early in your marriage. Let's see, you know, see where things go in a year or two or three. You know, maybe you'll grow a backbone. But until then, it's okay. It's not the not the worst thing in the world. All right, let's move on real quick because we're short on time. And I did want to hit up Jinder Mahal. After last week, and I said that he should go over clean on Brock Lesnar, and he's not even in the match anymore. What are your thoughts, Mike?
I mean, as far as Jinder Mahal, I think that at the end of the day, you and I have talked about this numerous times. They have put a lot of stock into him, obviously, you know, with the Indian market being such a big one. And you knew I've talked about that before. But I don't know. I just found it very hard for them to keep the strap on him. I just felt like there wasn't a whole lot of – as a heel, he didn't have a whole lot of heat. He wasn't getting a lot of responses from the crowd. And I thought it was exciting that he was going to take on AJ. And once again, you know, it's a televised thing. You know, I didn't think it would be a huge, huge deal. But AJ going over Jinder, I loved it.
Well, my point was never that Jinder Mahal was my favorite wrestler, or far from it, or that he was a big draw, far from it. And I had a conversation with my 22-year-old son last week as well, right after kind of we finished with the podcast and talking about it. And he was like, Jinder Mahal is killing the product. Jinder Mahal is killing the brand. They got to take the belt off of him. Nobody cares about him and Brock. And I said, I don't disagree with you. My point has always been that you're trying to get over in a market where you have, you know, over 1 billion people that are untapped. And that's the business answer to the question. And so if the 360 million people in the U.S. or the percentage of those who are fans of WWE don't like him, then you have to look past that and try to look at the business side. But for whatever reason, I guess rumors are Brock didn't want to work with him, didn't see any money. I mean, I don't know that I saw any money in Brock Lesnar versus Jinder Mahal. I saw money in Jinder Mahal in India, and they just didn't give it enough time. I know that they're scheduled to go to India in a few months. I also heard that he really hasn't since he's been champion, really the interest level has not gone up in India. So that might have been one of the reasons why they pulled the plug. But I do want to mention one thing. I had talked about a person who had urged Dixie 10 years ago to concentrate on India and China and just be the WWE in those two markets. You have, you know, a billion people there, and we talked about that. And she decided to go in another direction. And I did confirm I had an epiphany later on, and I spent the weekend with him a couple weekends ago as a guest of my fan fest. That was Kevin Sullivan who told Dixie that at a fan fest years ago that he thought that that they needed to only focus or majority focus on the Indian and Chinese market, and that they could be, you know, make a ton of money over there. And you know, Dixie wanted to be a big company in the U.S. and Canada and other places. So it didn't happen. So I just wanted to put a name to that story. And sorry, Jinder, it didn't work out. I understood the reasoning, if not, and I also understood the frustration of the fans. But sometimes making money is more important than making people happy. And I guess at the end, making people happy won off. So just wanted to follow up on that from last time as well, since we did talk about it. And as soon as I said he should go over Brock, the match was canceled. But congratulations to AJ Styles. And I look forward to AJ versus Brock. And that match will probably last 3 minutes. And that will be that. But I hope they give him some time. But I just don't see it.
Maybe they'll put the strap on Jinder when they go over to India. Maybe see if they can get a good pop from the crowd and have him win the belt over there. Maybe that might spark a little interest in him. You know what I mean?
We'll see. I mean, I don't think this is the end for him. They definitely decided that now is not the time to keep going. And so we'll see what happens. My point is that, you know, you're going to piss off 5,000 people in Allentown, Pennsylvania, but you also want to draw, you know, five nights of 100,000 seat stadiums in India. You know, so that's 500,000 people. Imagine how in five nights. Now, I'm not saying they could draw that, but that's the ultimate goal. And how many 5,000 seat arenas do you have to pack around the world? How many days do you have to do that to equal the amount of money that you could make in five nights if you could get 100,000 people in there a night? So that was the thought process. And at the end, as usual, my 22-year-old son was right, and they took the title off of him, and I had to eat crow. So I still stand by the business decision, but I think AJ against Brock will be at least a bigger interest match, if not a better match. I don't. Just depends.
You think they'll put AJ over Brock?
No.
Really? You think they're going to keep this process of Brock being just this eating machine going?
Well, yeah, because then when Roman beats him at WrestleMania, then, you know, he's the only one who could. He beat the monster. Undertaker couldn't beat the monster. Cena couldn't beat the monster. AJ Styles couldn't beat the monster. Nobody could. Triple H couldn't beat the monster. But Roman Reigns beats the monster.
Oh, man. You love this Shield thing, this whole fist coming together. You love it.
It's all right. I'd much rather see AJ Styles, Nakamura tear down the house in front of 80,000 people in New Orleans. But
that would be awesome.
We'll see. We'll see. People like my son are hoping for that, but I don't know if Vince has the cojones, as he likes to say, to go through with that on his biggest stage of the year. But we shall see. Mike, again, thanks for being here, and we'll talk to you next week. My guest this week at Sitting Ringside is a friend of mine, longtime friend, and been through a lot with this individual. And if you look at his life and his career, it has an happy ending, but it's a lot of missed opportunities, a lot of what could have been. So it'd be interesting to talk about. Plus, we got a whole lot of other things to talk about as well. Ladies and gentlemen, Pat Kenny, Simon Diamond, welcome to Sitting Ringside, my friend.
Thanks, Pence.
So, Pence, I guess
you're going to put me in the same column as Marcus Dupree, the best that never was.
No.
I wish that was Marcus Dupree.
So I think before, you know, this is a wrestling podcast, so we're going to talk mostly wrestling, obviously. But I think that we need to start out. We talked about having a bet. Now, I want to be totally upfront. When this podcast drops, this game will already be over. So everybody's going to know the outcome, and we're going to know whoever lost the bet, whatever we decide to bet. We talked. I'm a longtime Miami Hurricane fan, been irrelevant for many, many, many years. You're a longtime Notre Dame fan. I'm a Miami Hurricane football fan. You're like a Notre Dame freak. And you guys haven't been as relevant, but more relevant than the Hurricanes have been. So where we find ourselves now is that a couple of days ago, but as we tape this in a couple of days, we're going to have a big game. The Hurricanes are undefeated. Notre Dame is one loss. We talked about making some kind of wager, and you thought it'd be better to talk about it on the show. So Throw it out there. What do you want to wager? Let's make it interesting.
Oh, jeez. I've had such a hectic day. I haven't even had time to think about it. It's got to be like some type of... Jeez. Like you gotta sing the fight song on.
Okay, so song. Okay, so here it is. So if the Hurricanes win, you have to come back on this show in the near future, and you have to sing the Hurricanes fight song. And you have to take a picture in a Hurricanes like a hat or a T-shirt or something like that. If Notre Dame wins, then I'll bring you on, and you can make me do whatever you want to do, and I'll take a picture holding the Notre Dame sign or something. How about that?
Then you got it.
I'm feeling easy better. Enough. I'm actually feeling better about your chances than I am about ours, because we've been, other than last week, we've been winning a lot of games at the last minute, and we're not going to be able to pull that off against Notre Dame. But
you know, the thing is, I watched Miami last week against Virginia Tech. And I was impressed with the quickness of their D-line, undersized though, but the quickness of their D-line, played a lot of the game in the backfield. And their quarterback, who, you know, I hadn't heard much about, but I was impressed by what I saw. Now, he threw three picks.
Yeah, he got in a little funk there. He got in a little funk there for about a quarter. And but that was actually one of his better games because, like I said, we've been coming back from behind or just barely holding on. Which is why we're not ranked higher. I'm hoping we win. Obviously, I certainly don't want to be singing a fight song on my own podcast for a team that I'm not a fan of, and give you that satisfaction that goes along with it. But I'm thinking if we do lose, if we could just kind of hang around and be close, have it a close game, then because you guys are a one loss team and we'd be a one loss team, maybe we'd still be in the discussion. I don't know, depending on how our last two games went, but
it'd be. If Clemson's a top four team, and you play them in the ACC championship with one loss, and you beat them, you got a shot.
Yeah. So we just have to hang around. But I'm thinking this is a magical season, and I'm hoping for the best. So we got that bet down, and I hope I win. We talked earlier to my associate producer in this podcast about we went a little in depth on the 30 for 30 special on Ric Flair. I know you're a big fan of Ric Flair, as we all are. Wondering if you watched it and what you thought.
I saw it. I was very impressed with the documentary. The only thing I would say is it was a little scattered at times, but I thought overall it was very well done. Of course, his story, which, you know, I know and you know, because, you know, we're quote unquote in the business. So we're aware of it. It's heartbreaking, you know, but it's a typical story of professional wrestling, which people don't understand. I've tried to explain it to them, and I'm sure you have, but people aren't going to understand is that you have to give up almost everything in your life to be successful in this industry. And, you know, that's exactly what he, you know, did.
Yeah, I think it even went a little bit farther, and I talked about this earlier in the podcast. Like I said, Hulk Hogan, when he was done being Hulk Hogan, even though he was away, you know, as much as Rick was and all that, he could turn off being Hulk Hogan, and he was Terry, and he, you know, did things, normal, you know, family things.
Agreed.
Rick couldn't turn it off. No, never.
Never.
So.
Never. And I was saying the other day, I said, you know, Piper, out in front of the camera was a maniac. Behind the scenes, very different. Hogan, same thing. Behind the scenes, very different.
Well, it depends which Piper you got. There was two Roddy Pipers.
Yeah,
and okay. I was on this. Okay. I could write a book about this maybe sometime, but I always say I would never write a book because I wouldn't have any friends left. Or probably my kids and my wife wouldn't speak to me either. But, you know, I was on a tour bus with Roddy Piper for almost 40 days, going around the country, as the tour manager for his book tour, back in the day and right after the XWF, which we'll talk about. But, you know, you never knew which one was going to wake up in the morning or which one you're going to see at night. And, you know, there was one that was, very caring and very, loving person. And then there was one that he wasn't a jerk. He was just very demanding because you work for him and he had certain goals and he was very demanding, but just never knew which one you were going to get. But we'll get to Roddy because you got to do some interesting stuff with Roddy. And
him and Lawler.
And Lawler, yeah. And that was all my idea. I'd love to take credit on this show for like the few things I've done. I've only done a couple of things, but I will put myself over, sure. If I happen to do them. Because there's a lot that I didn't do. So let's talk about your story. Before even professional wrestling, you had, if the story is true, you had the opportunity to play. Now, you played high school baseball, correct?
Yes.
Very sought after.
I played basketball and baseball in high school. I went on and played baseball in college at Virginia Commonwealth University. My sophomore year, we were 22nd in the nation. We went to the Mid-Atlantic Regional in Miami. Funny story, when we went there, we got a tour. Now, this is 1988. We got a tour of the facilities, the football facilities, and I refused to go in because I was such a big Notre Dame fan. And
I see some things haven't changed, huh?
No. And, I wasn't much different back then, so I refused to go in. But, I played there.
Now, did you have an offer? You weren't drafted, were you? But you just had an offer.
Yeah, out of high school. But this is where I think the story gets hazy with some people is you either sign or you don't. I did not. I chose not to because, back then the money, there was no money to guys, after the first 10 to 15 rounds. So
where were you drafted? Where were you drafted?
34th.
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 So Kevin Kiermaier is probably your hero.
Piazza was like a 40th.
There you go.
Something, I think. But, they call it dragging the nets after 20-something. I don't even know how many rounds they have now. But, I had scholarship offers. And I thought, the thought process is always, well, I'm here now. But, and the thing, if Division I college baseball is, it's very different than football and basketball. You can't leave until after your junior year. You cannot leave. They cannot draft you until after your junior year. So you're locked in for 3 years.
Right.
And, but then I had gotten hurt after my sophomore year. And I was never the same.
So any regrets looking back or you just didn't want to toil in the minor leagues?
Regrets? I like to call it a learning experience, I think is a better term, from what I went through. So I learned a lot that hopefully I can pass down, to my son, young Bryce.
Young Bryce.
Yeah. But he's not even two yet, so who knows, but I'm teaching him how to throw and he's kind of getting it. So
there you go. I wish you were around to help my kids because I had no athletic ability at all, especially when it comes to baseball. Jeez.
My daughter's insanely athletic. Insane. She's 7. I mean, it's insane. Like, I watch her and I was like, wow, that's me. That's me at that age. Like, but no, I don't have regrets. I mean, I just, it is what it is. It was what it was. And I have a lot of great memories from it. I played on a lot of great teams and met a lot of great people. And I have a big fat Sun Belt championship ring from 1988 that is somewhere downstairs in the man cave.
There you go.
I don't know where, but it's somewhere down there. So if I ever find it again and get it resized, I can wear it. People go, what's that? And then I can tell all the stories.
You better go check and make sure it's still there because things have a way of disappearing. I had the final Monday Nitro script. That I was waiting for the right time to make copies and start selling it on eBay. I was just waiting for the right time when I wasn't really around the business anymore and there wasn't a lot of heat over that kind of stuff. And I figured I'd sell it for $5 a pop and see how many I could sell. And I used to keep it in a special place, and I'd be darned. I've been looking for that thing the last 2 or 3 years. I can't find it. So those things have a way of disappearing. So you need to go find that ring. So, but you did get a college education. So
yes, I actually went back and finished my degree. I had gotten offered a great opportunity with PepsiCo, who I was working for in the summers, doing grit work, and my boss at the time, who played baseball at the same high school that I did, he said, that's how I got the job. And then he said, what are you doing? And I said, I think I'm going back to school. He says, well, there's a great job opening and I think you should interview for it. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And I interviewed for it. And then 2 days later, he called me in his office and said, the job's yours if you want it. So then I had to go home and tell my parents I wasn't going back to school. And that was interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But I did enroll at Westchester University in Westchester, Pennsylvania, where where PepsiCo was, the bottling company. And so I had enrolled school there, but I never, I think I took one class. I may have even dropped it just because work was, oh my goodness. You talk about a job that just grinds you down. But then I finally, then I started wrestling and I made a conscious decision to go back and finish my degree, which I finished in 96.
So let's go back. Were you a wrestling fan growing up, I'm assuming?
So I was, I was a kid with ADD.
I still am a kid with ADD.
Yeah, right. I needed that, constant attention grabbing things. And one day I'm flicking the channels on the old TVs where the remote was attached to the TV. Remember those days?
Yeah. And that was like considered a convenience because you didn't have to,
yes,
to stand,
yes,
up to change the channel. Oh, we're both looking, yeah, we're both dating ourselves, man. We're exposing ourselves.
50. Pens, I'm going to be 50 this year.
Yeah, I'm 51.
All right. And I'm flicking the channels and I see Captain Lou Albano and the Valiant Brothers in the ring. And I'm going, what is this? This is unbelievable. Then they go to a interview with, I think it was Superstar Billy Graham and Backlund. It was right after Backlund had, right before Backlund had won the belt. Billy Graham and the Grand Wizard, phenomenal. And then I started watching all of them. We got Championship Wrestling from Florida, TBS. There was 4 and 5. Saturdays back in the day from 10 a.m. to 1, and then from 5 o'clock to 8 o'clock, and then midnight was wrestling. So my day was basically get up, watch cartoons, wrestling, probably had some type of sporting event, come home, probably had chores to do before that 5 o'clock WWF show, and then 6 to 8 was TBS, and then midnight you would see the following week's All-Star Wrestling, WWF.
WOR, correct?
Yes. After the harness racing.
Exactly, the harness racing. Oh, my God.
But
your memory is uncanny, man. That's going back a long way. Yeah, I remember the harness racing.
It would be going off there, and they'd be like, we'll see you next week from Yonkers. And then, the music would start. This week on Championship Wrestling. But my favorite part of those shows was 20 past the hour and 22 the hour when Vince McMahon, remember Vince would stand there with the yell, this wrestling returns this Saturday to the beautiful air-conditioned Philadelphia Spectrum, where coming into view with his manager, the Grand Wizard of Wrestling, Superstar Billy Graham, will get his shot at trying to get his championship belt, Superstar. Remember, and then he would walk into the scene with the Wizard, and the Wizard, we will get revenge on Backlund. And then Superstar Billy Graham was in there, the greatest mind in the world, the largest arms in the world, and the greatest hold. It was magic. It was absolute magic. I loved it.
Favorite part was, I grew up on Championship Wrestling from Florida, but my favorite part was always Gordon Solie reading See, I couldn't see what you were seeing up there. They just showed.
No, sir.
Yeah, but Gordon Solie reading the card for the next week at the Miami Beach Convention. This Wednesday.
Freddie Miller
in Atlanta. Sure,
Freddie Miller.
But
Freddie Miller, the greatest angle of all time, happened on Georgia Championship Wrestling.
What's that?
How did you know I had four flat?
I knew you were going to say that. I asked. We had Kevin Sullivan.
Idolmania is running rampant, brother.
I talked to Kevin Sullivan about that a lot. He was on the podcast when we first started out, and
I spoke to him a couple months ago.
We just had a championship wrestling from Florida Fan Fest that I co-promoted, and him and JJ Dillon were the stars, the featured guests. So he was down here, spent the whole weekend with him, had some drinks, and but yeah, I loved the. I gave him my word, Gordon. I can't do the Boston accent.
Yeah.
But I gave him my word. You know, the whole freaking show. I gave him my word, and
I gave him my word, Gordon. Tremendous. Give it to me, Sullivan. I remember Give It to Me Sullivan too when they finally shook hands.
Yeah.
You know, he's bleeding. Idol's bleeding, and they said, you know, and Gordon Sully's going, it'll be this Sunday at the Omni where these two men and Austin Idol put his hand out, and he said, give it to me, Sullivan! And Sullivan shook his hand. I remember that week in school, me and, like, all my regular friends hated pro wrestling, but I had one friend that liked it, so he and I would always talk about wrestling. So in school, we were doing we were going up to each other going, give it to me, Sullivan! And we were shaking hands.
I love that angle. Nobody said anything about four flat tires. I said I had one flat tire.
I didn't say anything about why you. Oh, so good. That wrestling back then was so good. And I still to this day try to figure out, was it because I was young or was it because it was so, so good?
It was because it was so good. No, it was because it was so, so good.
It was because it was character-based. It was character-based. That's it. You know, the storylines were simplistic. The characters were over the top, but they were very, very real to those that were playing them. That's the biggest difference.
Sure, absolutely.
In yesterday's wrestling to today's. That's the biggest difference.
Absolutely. So when did you decide, hey, I'm sick and tired of toiling for PepsiCo. I'm going to try to become a professional wrestler.
I went, there was a guy, so I get promoted. I get this big promotion. Well, not big, but I get a nice promotion. But part of the promotion is I got to be there now in the plant to sign out trucks at 5 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, that would be a deal breaker for me.
Yeah. So, I got to be honest with you, there were some nights I didn't even go home. I was out drinking with friends, and I would just go into the parking lot and fall asleep. And I had this watch that, those electronic watches, and I would set my alarm on it. And I had the same clothes on I wore before, and I'd just walk in there and I'd get a white Pepsi collared shirt and put that on. But anyway, there was a guy in the warehouse.
Now, could you do that now? Could you pull that off now? It amazes me how when you're like, 20 something years old, you could pull that stuff off. And when you get to be our age, you couldn't pull that off. I couldn't pull that off if I tried my very hardest.
There's no way. There's no way. I'll be up tomorrow at 6:20 a.m. Get my daughter on the bus, but not after I've been out drinking all night. But so he drove one of the trucks, and he was a pro wrestler, and he and I, I was a huge fan, and he and I would talk, and then one day he said, you should go talk to the guy who trained me. He has tryouts every couple months. So I went and talked to him, a guy by the name of Jim Kettner, and started, did a tryout and, a bunch of other guys and got picked and just started training.
I mean, ECWA, really, if I remember correctly, was that?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And I didn't look on the internet. That was from memory, folks.
Which was groundbreaking at the time because it had the first, there's so many of these independent wrestling tournaments, but the ECWA had the first super independent tournament called the Super E, which I helped create with Jim, because I used to watch a lot of Japanese tapes back then. I don't know why, but I did. But and I helped him create the Super E, which was a springboard for myself, Chris Ford, Crowbar, the Hardys, Billy Kidman, I mean, the list is endless.
Yeah, I remember the Super 8. I had forgotten about that, but that was the first one. That was the first sort of independent tournament.
Yes, absolutely.
And you guys brought in all the, like, you know, all the names that were over in the Meltzer crowd with you know, on the
before there was internet,
it was the guy. It would be like now. It would be like the 2 years ago. It'd be like Kenny Omega would headline. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I always tell everyone, the first super independent class was myself, a guy by the name of Ace Darling, Devin Storm, and Reckless Youth, and we were all in the same area. You know, we were all in the New Jersey, New York, Philly, Delaware area. And we were like the first, you know, super independent class. And then I would say after us was probably like Low Key and Daniels and those guys, Kazarian, you know, but we were the first. And it was right about the time the internet started.
Sure.
You know.
The message boards and the – I never was involved in any of that. But the message boards and the – I don't even remember what it's called. So you start working ECWA and Super 8 and eventually catch a break with ECW at the very end of ECW's lifespan, correct?
98. I had actually talked to Paul. I did the Eddie Gilbert Memorial for Dennis Carluzzo. And Meltzer was there, and I had a big three-way match with Reckless Youth and Cheetah Master where I won the, what was it called, North American, NWA North American Championship, which at one point was pretty prestigious.
Now, was Cheetah Master Ted Petty?
No, this was a different Cheetah Master. And Meltzer had put me over as the star of the show. And
so you were Kenny Omega years and years, decades before Kenny Omega.
I don't know if I was.
Oh, I'm talking about Meltzer's favorite.
Reckless Youth was more like Kenny Omega.
Yeah, maybe so.
So he put me over, and then Paul called me, but I was just getting ready to get my. I had to get my my first of two shoulder surgeries from years of abuse with baseball and other things. So I was just getting ready to get that. So that kind of delayed me a little bit. And then I started in 98, May of 98, I believe, May 6th in York, PA, against Nova, who I'd known, you know, coming up through the independents.
And was it his idea to put you with Swinger, Paul, or?
Well, so I had just signed my contract with ECW. We were in Georgia. We were in Marietta, I believe. And I talked to Steve Carroll, who was the financial guy behind ECW. Very dry, very dry guy. And I remember
you got to be pretty dry if you're the money guy behind ECW back then.
Well, he says to me, so Fonzie comes up. So first you see Steve Carroll, who rarely came to the shows, right? So he comes to the show. And I talked to Paul the week before, and Paul kind of laid out the terms, and me being the constant negotiator that I am, kind of negotiate a little bit. And then Steve Krause shows up. Paul was not there. Steve Krause shows up, and first you see him talking with Raven in this chair in the middle of the locker room, like the complete middle of the locker room. He has this chair. He's sitting in a chair, and he's got this other chair, and Raven sits down first. And he talks to Raven. He gives Raven his release. So now Fonzie comes up to me and he's like, "Hey, Danny, Steve Krause said as soon as Raven gets up, you're in to run into that seat and sit down." I'm like, "All right." You know, so I run over exaggeratedly, sit down, and he said, "Well, I'm here to do two things. The first one was to get, well, no, he said three things. The first one was to give Raven his release, which I have done. The second was to fire Paul, which I have done as well. And the third is to offer you a contract." And I said, "You fired Paul?" He goes, "No, I was just kidding." I said, "Oh, that's pretty funny." Like, this guy, he was just dry. He was very dry. So then, you know, he laid out the terms of my contract, and I shook his hand, and then I called Paul and said, you know, we got a deal. And so then Dreamer comes up and he says, "Here are your choices. You can either wrestle." So Dusty's there too. Dusty, they're going to start the program with Dusty and Carino, right? And he says, "Dusty's here. You can either work Swinger you can work against Swinger. In the second match, are you and Swinger can work a local team, two of Dusty's students, in the first match. And I knew we had the tag team tournament coming up, so I was like, you know what? This is a good opportunity to get into that, to make sure I'm booked on that tag tournament, number one. And number two, I would love to wrestle Dusty's students because Dusty's going to watch it and he's going to give me feedback. And sure. I also, and here's a little hidden gem for all the ECW fans that listen to your show. Paul, the original plan at the time that I signed that contract was to put me, CW, Carino, and Swinger together as a four horsemen type of group, which later came to fruition in MLW
sure.
with me, CW, and Carino as the extreme horsemen. And then we had interchangeable parts on the fourth, PJ, Just Incredible, Barry Windham. So that was the original plan.
Love the inside baseball.
It clicked from the beginning. We just clicked from the beginning.
So how long did that run last? Because I know ECW didn't, maybe
so
a year?
It closed in 2001. It closed. So I was there for 3 years. A lot of ups and downs. A lot of bounce chat. Well, not
what,
a lot.
What percentage of the time that you work would you say that you got paid?
Ooh, 65% to 70%.
That's not bad. Back in the end of
I started. You know what I was doing at the end? I started hedging my bets on two fronts. The one thing I would do was I would book when I had a. I was like, I don't think we're gonna. I think we're gonna get the call that the shows are canceled. They started canceling shows at the end. So I started booking. Booking myself out on weekends to indie shows. And then the other thing I did was I went because we started doing a lot of things up Northeast. So I had a friend come to the shows and I would get him a bunch of comp tickets and then he would go sell them and I would give him a cut of what he sold. And then I would pocket the rest.
That's funny. I remember you telling me, I remember you telling me that story years ago. And I didn't remember.
Made a killing at the Hammerstein. Made a killing.
Now, did Paul know about this?
No, nobody did. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell anyone because you know what happens in wrestling. It'll get ruined.
Yeah,
then
of course.
Everyone will do it. And
yeah,
then
of course.
It'll flood the market.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did it. I always had that entrepreneurial spirit. I had it in college when me and a friend of mine would put on our VCU baseball sweats and we'd go out to the wealthier neighborhoods in Richmond and we'd have a fake raffle and we'd hold a fake raffle. And I mean, we'd make $200-$300 in a couple hours, you know,
and there was no payoff.
Nobody was winning that. I mean, we looked official. We had the VCU baseball stuff on, my buddy
wow.
carried a clipboard. I did all the talking, you know, hi, I'm Pat Kenny. I'm playing catcher VCU baseball. This is Mike Cunningham, second base. Want to know if you guys are interested in our spring fundraiser. Third place is $50 gift certificate to Disco Sports. Second place is a season tickets to VCU baseball. First place is an all expense trip to the Final Four. Would you be interested? I never win those things. How much are your tickets? They're $5 each or 3 for $10. Give me ten.
Wow.
$10. Here you go. Bang.
That's
like that.
That's I'd say that's tremendous, but people would think I was a horrible person, but.
But in college, it's a hustle. It's just a hustle.
I see. See, you accomplished way more than I, because you finally got your degree. I didn't get my degree. You actually made money, and the most I did was try to block the Domino's guy from coming in, so I could get into the dorm, so I could get the free pizza if they didn't deliver in 30 minutes. So we'd lock all the doors and put furniture up.
Tremendous.
But that's the most I did. You were conning people out of money, thinking they were in a raffle for the official college baseball team. I can't even think of the word.
It's a hustle. It was a hustle. It was my, I mean, we would have utilities. I remember in the wintertime, we had our utilities cut off because we decided we'd rather, you know, drink beer and party than pay our hot water bill on our off-campus apartment, or house. Actually, we're living in a house. And so you get cut off and we turn the water on and it was freezing cold and you jump in for 5 seconds and get wet and then you soap up and wash your hair and then you jump back in, rinse off 5 seconds and that was it. And it's just a hustle, but you learn from it and there's a lot of times in my life when I think back on that stuff and it drives me. It motivates me.
You're like an entrepreneur. I mean, you know, you can't, that's like,
well, I am now.
I we'll get to that. So I can't get over that story. I can't get past it. That's absolutely tremendous. So back to ECW. I do have one more question. How many percentage of the times that you flew to a town did you fly under? This is way before 9/11. Before you had to show all kinds of ID. Did you fly under a different name or on a bereavement fare?
Twice, maybe.
Tell the story about the bereavement fair tickets that Paul used to do.
So he would call in.
This might have been better than the telling the baseball raffle tickets, actually. But
so Paul would call in on and get a reduced fare on people that are a family death. And the funniest thing was you didn't have to show a death certificate. So, I mean, there was a pretty decent percentage of the at times at the, when the roster was flying in on a bereavement fare. And I don't know how people at the airlines could never put two and two together when, I mean, out of Newark, we had me, Nova, Doring, Dawn Marie, Big Sal, who else? Balls, God rest his soul. Scully Mack, Big Vito.
I mean, all flying on bereavement fares.
I don't know. We all. I mean, I'm sure. I think one time Doring and I were both on a bereavement fare, and they would tell you sorry for your loss when you got on the plane. Sorry for your loss, and you're like, huh? What? And then you get to the show, and other guys would be talking about it. You go, oh, okay, I get it. We were all on the bereavement fare. But hey, you know, Paul, that's the hustle for Paul. You know, he hustled. He hustled to keep it going.
He certainly did. I always got a kick out of the bereavement fares. You know, we live in this PC culture right now, or like, you can't do anything. And now we're telling these stories, and I hope we don't offend anybody. But
I'm sure we've offended tons of people. But ask me if I care. I don't care.
I'm offended myself, quite frankly. But no.
Like, don't you get to a point in your life where you just don't care anymore? You're just like, I think it's like after 40 something, like maybe 48, you just get to a point in your life where you're just like, I don't care anymore. You might offend them. I don't care. My wife all the time, she's like, you're obnoxious, you're this, you're that. I'm just like, I don't care.
Well, the Notre Dame stuff is pretty offensive to almost everybody, but we'll see. I'm hoping to have the last laugh on that. So is it true that at the end, I had never known this, but it's in on some websites. Is it true that after you left ECW that, no, this isn't anything bad, that you were actually in negotiations with WCW to come in?
Yeah, I went to, got a call that Johnny Ace wanted, it was after ECW closed, got a call that Johnny Ace wanted to meet with me. Yeah, he was also meeting with Carino that night in Baltimore, is when Dusty and Flair did the thing in Baltimore. And we met him at the bar after the show at the hotel bar.
No Sabatinos?
No, it was not. There was no Sabatinos. So walked in, sat down with Johnny. Would you like a beer? And I said, I think is that a trick question that you're offering me a beer? Because, I said, I usually would drink it, but I think you might be asking me a trick question. Is that a trick question? Okay, I'll take a beer. And he had a little six pack of Coors Light right by his feet. Talked with him for a while. Ricky Santana popped his head in a couple times. Met Flair that night. Kevin Nash. I think I met you. Met Bischoff, and then
I can tell you, I can promise you one thing: you didn't meet me and Bischoff at the same time for sure.
No.
I didn't get much communication with Bischoff, let alone walking into the same room together, unless it was a pure coincidence. And then I got a dirty look.
But he had, so evidently he had met with a couple ECW guys from what I found out. And one of the things he said, which I was kind of pumped about, but I also wore my, I had these like shoes that had this really, really thick heel, like a, you know, like 2.5 inch thick heel. And he was like, you're the biggest guy of all the guys that I've talked with, you know, and I'm, I mean, what, 6'1", 2, at the time, 235-ish, 240-ish maybe. But so I guess I appeared to be like 6'3". So, I was pumped about that. But then I, so I get a call a couple of days later from Ricky Santana, and they wanted me to come in to, I want to say it was that outdoor show. What was the outdoor show you guys did, the spring break?
The one that was the last night show of all time?
Was that the last one? No,
yeah,
it wasn't that
yeah.
one. Okay, but it wasn't that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, come in for a tryout as we hand the company
yeah,
over
the
to Vince McMahon.
But I was supposed to work Cash. I was supposed to work Kid Cash. And I remember talking to Cash. He's like, oh, we're in, baby. We got this. And if I'm, you know, we're working each other. I was like, yeah. But so now, I get a call from him, and I'm like, okay, great. And then I get a call like a day later, and now they want a written release from Paul. I need a written release from Paul. And Paul still hasn't appeared on Raw yet, or maybe he had. I can't remember. Anyway, so now I got to call Paul and get a release. So I'm talking to Paul, and he's like, what are they offering you? And I was like, well, you know, the standard contract, I think at the time, was $500 a week, $500 per match. And he said most of the guys on these deals were working 3 and 4 times a night on those Thunder deal, on those Thunder shows and all the other things you guys were doing.
Yeah, Saturday night and all that.
Yeah, he said, you know, most of the guys, he started rambling off a guy. He's like, you know, this guy, you know, they're all working 3 and 4 times a night. So, you know, you're probably looking at about like, you know, about three grand a week. You know, and I was like, oh, yeah, I can do that. So he's like, is it guaranteed? I was like, well, no, I got to, you know, come in first, and they want to get a look at me, get me in front of Eric. You should call Eric and tell him you want $1 million guaranteed. Then he'll know you're a player. I was like, I start laughing. I was like, you're insane. He goes, I'm serious. Let's call him together. I was like, no. And now this conversation, by the way, is taking place at like 2:30 in the morning. So then I can't remember how it ended, but then they call me the next day and they like, are you?
He didn't call Eric and say that, did he?
No, not at all. So then they're like, did you get your release? I said, no, I have not gotten it yet. But I'm working on this. And well, we need it by tomorrow. You're not coming over this week. So then I call Paul. And now I got to chase him. Good luck with that. And then it became a merry-go-round between me and Ricky Santana. And then the word came down that, Bischoff was out and the company was on loose footing and it's crumbled.
Yeah, that was it. So,
I mean, it was just like that. I mean, it was just like I missed, you know, the 1 week, and then the next week I'm chasing Paul, and then I got pushed again, and now Bischoff's out. And like in the span of 3 weeks, it just, like,
well,
the bottom dropped out.
We a little perspective for you. We knew that, you know, that things were in bad shape. We thought Eric was going to buy it. But, I mean, literally, it was on a Wednesday. You know, they had on WCW's website, it had the WWF logo, purchases in the middle, and then on the bottom left, WCW logo. So that's how I found out about it. I turned on someone smartened me up. I turned on the website and it announced that WWF had purchased WCW. And then, you know, we go Monday and they did the angle where Shane came out, and that was it. That was the end. So it happened like in, you know,
it was a long drawn out negotiation.
It was like, it was like, we're not going to be on network. We're not going to renew our shows on the network. So Vince, you want to buy it? Give us your best offer. And boy, did he get a deal.
Oh my God, $1 million.
So
I got that money back.
At that point, you're thinking, do you get discouraged at all? Because it's like, ECW didn't work out. WCW is going to be big, didn't work out. You getting discouraged? Because if you weren't, I bet XWF discouraged you at the end.
Discouraged, I've always had an innate ability to look past the gloom, and doom.
God, in this business, you got to. If you're not in this business, you're miserable.
I've always, no matter what I did, I always look past the, excuse my French, shit sandwich, and in hopes of the filet that I'd be eating. So, I always did that.
So we brought you into the XWF.
Yes.
And not even 100% sure how it happened, but.
Cash called me, Kid Cash called me, and, he was like, send your stuff to Jimmy. I talked to Jimmy about you, send your stuff to Jimmy. So I sent my stuff to Jimmy, and then I got a call from, it might have been you.
It would have been me, yeah.
Was it you?
Yeah, it would have been
me. Okay, then you called me, and you said, or no, Jimmy called me, actually. Jimmy called me.
It would have been Jimmy.
Okay, so Jimmy called me and said, yeah, we're going to use you for the tapings, and here's how much we're going to pay you, and we're putting some guys on retainer, and would you be interested in that? And here's the, the retainer situation, and we'll talk to you more at the show. So I was like, yeah, awesome. And then I show up for the tapings.
If my memory serves me right, not to say this as an insult, but you and Swinger weren't in for like and Dawn weren't in for like a big push. It was like, you're going to do something underneath the Road Warriors and Nasty Boys and Shane Twins. You're going to do like an underneath tag team angle with Public Enemy.
Absolutely.
So. Yep.
Exactly the plan.
Yeah. And so.
And then I got a microphone. Then I got a microphone in my hand.
And you got a microphone in your hand. Jerry Lawler came to the show and said, I was just offered, and this ended up being we did a whole episode with Knobs on the XWF, and this ended up being the common thread, but Lawler came to the tapings and said, oh yeah, Vince just offered me my job back, so I'm going to take it. And we said, all right, well, you at least do the tapings, and he did them. So we wanted to find a way to get Lawler involved physically, and I don't remember if it was Jimmy or myself, but I'll take credit. It's probably a little bit of both because we usually sit on the same thing. But everybody was like, "All right, how can we get Lawler involved?" Don't take this the wrong way. So he's not, we got somebody who could talk, somebody who's a name, but it's not. We're not having him beat down one of our top guys. On his way out of the territory, basically.
So we don't disrespect them. Yep,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And either I or Jimmy or both of us said, I think Simon Diamond could pull it off and go ahead from there. Cause we put a microphone in your hand and you ran with it, man.
It was like, I came out and me, Swinger, and Dog came out and I ran him down and we jumped in there and had a quick little impromptu match. And, then I walked through the back and who was the guy who died of a heart attack? God rest his soul. When
Mike,
he found out that yes. Yeah.
Can't think of his last name.
He comes walking up to me and hands me a microphone. He goes, you're in the next segment. Did anyone talk to you about it? And I go, no. And he goes, you're going to be out there with Piper. Get with him. And I said, what? And I'm standing there. I got the mic right in my hand, and here comes Piper. I was like, hi, Roddy. And he goes, just we'll have some fun out there, and just you'll know when to attack me. I said, okay. And that was it. I mean, that was it. And I just went out there, and I'm standing in the ring with Roddy Piper, probably the greatest villain in the history of the business, one of the greatest talkers. And I just because I was so excited and genuine, my genuine emotion came out. It was just, it was real. It was real. I was, what I was saying to him, and it just worked. It clicked. And then I started doing the house shows, and we would go out there and do our little shtick, and then I'd wrestle Norman Smiley. And it was probably one of the highlights of my career was being in the ring with Roddy Piper and getting to go back and forth on the microphone with him and getting to pick his brain before and after. And he told me something that has stuck with me my entire career. And I said, what's the highest one? I said, what's the one thing you always try to accomplish when you go out there? He goes, I want everyone in that arena to believe that I'm real.
Yeah, he did.
Absolutely. I mean, he was Roddy Piper. So, I mean, you know, you can probably fill it in. I remember you telling me at the gas station, you were like, just wait, man, when this thing gets on TV, your life's about to change. I remember you telling me at that gas station that one day when everyone was filling up their car.
You were up for a big push. You were going to be one of the main antagonists, one of the top heels in the company. And I think the plan was to eventually I have a feud with you and Piper about who was going to be the commissioner, and do one of those commissioner feuds. Yeah. And
why couldn't that thing have gone on television? I would have been on the television talking every week and not taking any bumps.
There you go.
Oh, my God.
But
that was a dream job.
But again, it wasn't meant to be. I know that you have some memories of working for having Brian Knobbs as a boss, and also after match shenanigans with him. Anything that stands out?
Oh, the night in Austin. Were you there?
Yeah, I was there. But you love to tell the story, so I thought I'd let you tell it.
Okay, of course. So, well, thank you. Thank you. So it's the so first of all, you have me flying out of Philly with Ted Petty, and you have Jerry Toot and Johnny Grunge flying out of Newark. Basically, me and Teddy should have been flying out of Newark, and Jerry and Rocco, Jerry and Johnny Grunge should have been flying out of Philly. So we're all messed up. But so me and Ted go, and the guy who was supposed to pick me up and take me to Ted was running late. So we get to the airport, and just as I get there, you had sent me the old paper ticket. I was like, oh my God, I forgot my ticket. So Ted goes, drop me off. I'll see you there. So I drop him off, and I'm driving his big Cadillac. I'm driving, and I'm going over the bridge. And right as I'm going over the bridge, he calls me on my cell. Pat, turn around. I didn't make it. I said, all right. So I go back and I get him. And as we're in the car, and God bless Ted Petty. What a great human being. As we're in the car,
love Ted Petty.
Both of our phones are ringing and our girlfriends are screaming and yelling at us. At the time, he was dating Little Jeannie and I was with Dawn. And our girlfriends are screaming and yelling at us. And I'll never forget this again. Ted says, he goes, Pat, I've been in this situation at least 30 times because of Johnny. My suggestion is we turn off our cell phones, we pull off, we get a coffee, and we figure this whole thing out. And I go, that sounds like a good plan. So we went to Dunkin' Donuts and got a coffee. And so now we fly in from Newark. And when we fly in, as soon as we land, Johnny calls Ted, and they're still at the airport. So now we got to go get Johnny and Big Jerry. So now picture this car. You ready for this? Who's the oddball? Big Jerry Toot, Ted, Johnny Grunge, and myself. And we pull up to the arena, and the lights are flashing. The show canceled. And Jimmy comes running out. Hey, baby, everything's great, baby. We're going to do a little meet and greet. Just go in there. And then Knobs is going to talk to you. So, you know, I sit down there, and then Knobs like, come here, man. Let me talk to you. He's, you know, don't worry, everyone's getting paid. And, you know, we got big plans for you. And just hang in there with us. The TV deal's about to break. But the big news is we got a hookup at a bar downtown. And you got to go. I know. You got to get your own ticket. You got to figure out a way to get home. Because we're not, you know, paying for the transfer fee. So you can stay for the days and then fly home, or you can try to get out of here early and pay the transfer. And I said, don't worry about me. I'll take care of that. You know, I know how to hustle an airline agent. So anyway, so now it's me and Big Jerry and I think Cash. And we pull up to the bar and we come up the back. Remember the back steps of this place?
Yeah.
And Hawk, Hawk Animal, Valentine, and Piper are on the back deck, and they're participating in something that wasn't legal at the time. And I was like, wow, that's different. So now SAGs is getting real fucked up, and so is Knob, shockingly. And I'm in line to the bathroom, and they both come bursting out of the bathroom, and they grab me and throw me in there, and they're going to make me try to get me to try an illegal substance that I'd never tried before. And I smoked pot in college, and I did steroids, but so I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And they're like, yeah, you're going to do it, and we're going to beat the shit out of you. I said, well, you're going to beat the shit out of me, but I'm going to kick somebody in the knee when I'm going down. And they started laughing. And they're like, well, what do you do? I said, come on, well, let's go drink. Let's line them up.
Now, keep in mind, and, this is one of the bosses in the company.
Absolutely. But what better way to get yourself over with a boss than, take a couple swings at them. So we line up.
Gotta love the business.
I remember the Jack Daniels are lined up. And, I mean, I'm struggling with Jack Daniels, and he's just bang, bang, bang. And every time someone would tell Sags that they wanted to leave, Sags would take his beer, crack it on the bar, and shove it into the guy's face. Not hurt him jokingly, and be like, you sit down, no one's going nowhere. So then it's 2:00, and I know you remember this. The owner of the bar says, all right, guys, you got to go. And Sags cracks the beer bottle, shoves it into his face and says, no one's going nowhere. Locks the door. So he basically held the guy hostage while we drank. And the only reason everybody left was at like 4:00, the cops, a tow truck pulled down that alley where we were all parked. Remember that?
Yep.
I mean, you want to talk about an insane, and so what I kept doing was just to poke and prod and be an antagonist with Sags. So I would get up every, I'd tell Jerry too. I'd be like, Jerry, Big Jerry, watch this. And I get up and I'm like, Sags, man, I can't stay up. I got to go. Crack. There was the bottles cracked. Shoves it into my face. You're not going anywhere. Sit down. Oh, my God.
And Sags is like night. And Sags is like the less of the insane ones when they party.
Yeah. That was the funny thing is he was all fired up that night. I remember that. He was all fired. He must be, and he and I hit it off, too, because his daughter went to Notre Dame, and I was a huge Notre Dame fan. And
that's right. That's right.
He kept slapping me on the back as hard as he could. And, I mean, it hurt like you wouldn't believe. And I was just like, don't sell it. Don't sell it. Don't sell it. And he kept like sticking his face right into me going, you're going to sell it eventually.
So is Troy Nicholas a Notre Dame guy, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Because that's that's who his daughter ended up marrying.
Wow, tight end.
Yeah, tight end for the for the Cardinals.
Yeah, left early, left a year early.
Yeah, I didn't realize.
Wow, that's crazy.
I didn't realize. I forgot she had gone to Notre Dame. Yeah, you were over with him big time because his oldest daughter, that was the first one to go to college, so he was really proud. It was on a sports scholarship.
I remember I had to call. We had to call up there, like. I called up there like the following Tuesday, and I called up there and was Janie Engel was the secretary, right?
I wouldn't call Janie a secretary, but she's probably the one that picked up the phone. She was she was in charge basically, but she was the one that picked up.
She was the administrator, and I called and I said, hey Janie, it's Simon Diamond. I need to talk to someone there. Who's there? And she's like, hold on. And then Sags was on the phone. Yo, what's going on, man? You're one of my favorite new guys on the roster. So, yo, what's going on, Sags?
Yeah, could have been something, but it wasn't.
Yeah, it could have been. Oh, well, another missed opportunity.
Yeah. So you end up in TNA.
And, end up in TNA 2002, I think I started.
Just jumping around from place to place. That one lasted a while.
Yeah, I was, I'm like the ultimate gypsy. I was jumping around, and so we had a couple matches that we never really connected on, and then AMW, they put the belts on AMW, and they were having problems finding guys for AMW, and then Scott D'Amore was in TNA at the time, and he knew Swing, he and Swinger knew each other, and I knew Scott because we had worked, I'd done his little indie group, Border Championship Wrestling. I'd gone in there and done some shots for him. And so he recommended me and Swinger, and we went in there. We had a great match with AMW, and we got signed the next week, and that was 2003. And then I worked there pretty much regularly up until 2008, and then my contract ran out and they didn't re-sign me, and then I got hired back in like 8 months, And then from 2009 to June this year.
Yes, sir. And Scott DeMore is back in charge.
Yes, yes.
It's funny, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
The more they stay the same.
So
it was a great run. I mean, phenomenal run.
So what are some of your memories of that? I mean, at one point, it was a pretty hot company. Yeah, you know, you got Hogan and Flair.
I get asked all the time, and, you know, what was it like? You know, I became an agent in 2005, which is insane if you look. I mean, you look at my resume, and I'm sure a lot of people have. They're like, man, how's this guy an agent? And, you know, I didn't know what I was doing when I first started. And, you know, Terry Taylor had a lot to do with grooming me for the position. And, I'll never forget. I was at the house. So I'm aging the house shows. And I call in to Terry to let him know how the show was. You know, it's 11 o'clock at night. And I was like, all right, Terry, you know, I'll see you tomorrow at TV's. So I hang up. And 2 minutes later, he calls me back. He goes, Pat, I forgot to tell you, I'm handing over all duties with Hall and Nash to you. I can't deal with them anymore, and I think it'll be a great learning experience for you. So be prepared for tomorrow. You'll do fine.
He couldn't deal with them in WCW.
Click, and I'm like, what? I got an agent Hall and Nash. How am I going to do that? You know, but it was a great learning experience because I learned so much from the both of them.
I was going to say, the way you do that is listen.
That's all you do. You listen, and you kind of get them to buy into what you're doing by letting them talk it out, and they'll eventually talk themselves into doing what you need them to do for the betterment of the company. But they're going to do it the way they want to do it. You just got to make sure that that's the right way. And that's the nature of the job. So, but there was a time, I really believe there was a time there that TNA could have made a big move. And that's when they had, it was right when Kurt came in. Right when Kurt came in, and the feud was Kurt and Joe, and they put Kurt over Joe, and I thought that was a big I think that was the biggest mistake TNA ever made.
That was in Boston, correct?
Yeah, I think
pay per view in Boston. We had like 6,000 legit sellout. I was there.
Yep. They should have put Joe over, and only because he was the TNA guy. I understand why they put Kurt over. He was the, you know, fresh new face in. You don't want to damage, you know, the goods the first day in. But I would have put Joe over, and then I would have had Kirk come out and just say, wow, I really underestimated not only Samoa Joe, but TNA. And I realize now that I got to step my game up. And then you just have Kurt. Now Kurt chases, you know, you do the Rocky III gimmick with Apollo, where he goes to Joe and says, you know, I'm going to get that shot again. You know, you owe me, whatever. And he just tries to, you know, work from underneath and get that shot. And I think that was the opportunity. That was the missed opportunity, is putting their own guy, putting the stamp on their own guy, instead of putting it on a guy who had just been seen on Vince McMahon's TV.
Taking nothing
away from Kurt.
No, I totally understand. And I think probably Kurt would agree with you in hindsight.
Absolutely. And I remember he and I talked about this one night, and that was a missed opportunity to me. But, you know, working, I mean, there's so many memories, working with Hogan, you know, sitting in a trailer, running a finish by Hulk Hogan, you know, insane. Or sitting there and talking about, sitting by the pool with Ric Flair in Daytona and talking college football. And, I just texted Rick, you know, a month ago and telling him, you know, how happy I was that he had turned around and, you know, he had to be alive to watch his 30 for 30. And, you know, just, I mean, stuff like that. I mean, I was emulating him when I was in college, me and three of my roommates, one of which is now the GM for the Seattle Mariners, Jerry DePoto. And we used to call ourselves the Four Horsemen.
No way.
And we would all hang up. Yes. We would, the Four Horsemen sign would go up, you know, me, Jerry, Matt Mayer and Blair Wood, and we would throw the four. We all lived together at Glanning Residence Center in a quad, and we would call ourselves the Horsemen. You know, and one guy became a professional wrestler, the other guy became the GM of the Seattle Mariners. So there's a trivia question for you.
That's awesome.
Just so many memories.
As far as TNA goes, you were around at, I want to say the very end, but it's still going on, but at the very end of when Dixie owned it. And from what I understand, you know, it seemed to be a kind of crazy situation where, you know, there were some shows that they didn't know until, like, you know, until maybe a night before if they were going to have the funding to be able to put the shows on. Tell me a little bit about that. How much did you know about that? How much did they tell you as an agent?
Nobody knew a thing, which was always, I thought, one of the detriments of that administration was they kept everything secretive, and which in today's day and age, you have to be transparent. You just have to. But we didn't really know anything about it until afterwards, when you would hear, you know, that Billy Corgan came to the rescue to finance it, which then led to the problems that arose in the eventual lawsuit. But the biggest problem when all that stuff was going on was we had the hottest act in the wrestling business, and we couldn't use it to our advantage. Broken Matt Hardy and Death was the hottest act in the wrestling business, but we couldn't use it because we were battling, you know, as a company, we were battling each other in court.
That's crazy. Yeah, it was the hottest act in the wrestling business.
It was the hottest act in the wrestling business, you know, and there was a way to make money off of it, but we weren't in a position to make money off of it because we were, you know, busy battling in court. And again, you know, just very frustrating.
What were you, I know you didn't work for under him for too long, but what was your initial thoughts when Anthem bought in and took over? And did you think that do you think that they're going to be able to turn the ship around, or do you think it's just something that's run its course?
I hope they turn it around.
Yeah, I do too.
I really do, just because, you know, I still have friends there, and it's good for the wrestling business. I see a lot of cost cutting. The problem with cost cutting in business is, you can only cut so much until eventually. Yeah. It's all gone.
Well, there's a reason I'm talking to you tonight from Tampa, Florida, not from not from Canada. That's a part of that cost
there
cutting.
You go.
But
eventually someone has to, whoever it is, if it's Anthem or if someone else gets a hold of them, someone eventually has to put their feet in the ground and say, we're going to stop with the cost cutting, and we're going to spend money for X amount of years. And by year X, we expect this much return on our money. And until that happens, they will always be in the same situation that they are. You know, I've been very fortunate in my life to learn from a lot of great wrestling people, but also learn from a lot of smart people outside of the wrestling business and hold jobs in Fortune 500 companies. And if there's one thing I've learned, it's you have to spend money to make money. And if you're not willing to do that, then you will not be successful as a business. It's really just that simple. So whoever, you know, if Ed Nordholm is listening to this, Ed, my advice to you is this: put your feet in the ground, tell the people above you, I got this shit, but also tell them we're going to spend some money, and they're spending money, but you're going to spend a little bit more, and you're going to invest for the future, but have a plan. X amount of years, and then you're going to get the return on your dollar at year X.
Yeah, and I like that's it. I like it. I think Ed's a smart. I've, you know, talked with Ed a little bit, and I think he's a smart guy. And I just, again, like you said, I don't know how much longer, how much, you know, they're willing to keep the train running. You know, it could be a year. It could be 2 years. It could be 6 months. I just have no idea. I'm not in his mind. You know. You know, I wasn't surprised that I wasn't going up there, but I was kind of surprised when the refs didn't go.
They need something to capture the imagination of the internet fan, to change the perception that they have. And the perception is it's still retread TNA, and they're still treading water, and they're not a serious player in the professional wrestling business yet. But they need something to change that. And I don't know what it is. I mean, you know, I don't know if you hire one person or you hire a couple people or you go about putting it in an administration that, you know, costs a lot of money, but has an idea of, you know, where to go. I don't know, but, you know,
I know they were talking to Rey Mysterio, and I thought that could have been the last thing that could have really got
Rey would definitely help
back over the edge.
Rey would definitely help.
Yeah.
Rey would definitely help.
But it, you know, right now it doesn't look like that's going to happen, but, I really thought that that was the one thing that they could pull off that would have got the train chugging again and get the interest going.
Yeah, it's had its moments, that's for sure. You know, it's just another – it's in a position right now where it's just – it needs something. It needs something to breathe a new life into it. And it initially had it, I think, with Anthem and Jeff coming in January. And I think it had that. And then it just – you know, it's just kind of, it flat, I don't know, flatline is the right term and something. It just, you know, it just always seems to get, it gets a little momentum, and then the carpet comes out.
Well, and I don't think it helped. And, you know, that Jeff had some personal issues and it's not a secret. Nothing is a secret anymore these days in the world we live in. And, you know, Jeff had to take care of himself and his family. And so that sort of, I think, went the opposite direction of where they were hoping that would go. And,
absolutely.
Know, so that, you know, let's be honest, but you know, Jeff has to take care of himself and, you know, obviously there was something there. So, I think that kind of sort of got them back off the tracks, but Scott's a smart guy, Scott D'Amore.
Yep.
So I'm hoping that, with Scott and him being up in Canada, and it looks like they're going to move a lot of the headquarters to Canada, and I don't know if they're going to keep taping in Canada. I know that there's a lot of tax benefits for taping up in.
I don't say you get a lot of tax breaks in Canada.
Yeah, huge.
I know movies do.
Yeah.
So I mean, why at this point? I mean, the majority, you know, the administration, Anthem's headquarters are in Canada.
Sure.
You know, I'm surprised it hasn't moved there. If it, you know. If it hasn't already, and we just don't know.
Well, if you trust what you see and, you know, read, it looks like they're going to be moving almost everybody up there, or people will be working from their homes. But it does look like they're keeping the production in Nashville, so at least for now.
Yeah. So. Well, you don't need. I mean, you know, my father was a consultant, a business consultant for years, and he used to tell me all the time, you know, that he would go to these you know, companies and he would look at the offices and he would be like, man, this is a waste of money. I said, well, why is that? He goes, you don't need what do you need office space for anymore? Other than to show everyone how big you are. He goes, because everything can get done, you know, via the computer these days or the phone.
Yeah. I mean,
so the office space is a weight. It's an overhead that you don't need to, you know, incur.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a realtor, cause you were doing it too. And, we talked about it a little bit the last time I saw you in Impact. And, you know, I'm sitting in my office right now. You know, I have a home office and no reason to spend any money to open one, because there's nothing you can't do from your home office that you can't, you know, that you can't do anywhere else. So what?
I just started a new job.
Yeah, tell the people what you're doing now.
So I'm a business development manager for a company by the name of Rev Impact, search engine marketing, which is a fascinating industry. Which a buddy of mine owns, which I kind of fell. I mean, just talk about timing. We were talking and he was asking me how wrestling was going. I was like, they didn't, you know, resign my, they didn't renew my contract. And he said, well, you kind of told me you were expecting that. Right. And I said, yeah, you know, and I mean, to me, the honesty is, you know, I remember the first time, I remember in 2008, when I got the call from Terry Taylor to tell me they weren't going to renew my contract, and I was devastated. You know, I have no qualms telling you about it. And I even cried later. I was so devastated. And this time when I got the call, and I was just, it was like a sense of relief, because, you know, once you start having kids, it's all different. It's all different. And I didn't want to travel. You know, I was done with, I was sick of traveling. And, I remember when my daughter said, why do you have to travel so much, Daddy? And I was like, oh my God, that's it. Start the clock. But anyway, so I told him, and this is my friend. I told you the story about selling his house and then he bought the big house.
Yes, sir.
so he owns this company. And so I was telling him, and then that Saturday I went up there to watch Notre Dame and who they play after Georgia. They lost North Carolina, Boston College. And we're talking, and I said, what's going on? You know, how are things working? It's like, I just had to, you know, get rid of a guy, and now I got to go find a guy who can sell for me, and, you know, who I like, because I got to spend time with this guy. And, you know, there's not many of those. Wait a minute. You, I'm going to give you the job. I was like, what? So he's like, you know, here's how much you're going to make. Here's what you're going to do. I was like, oh, I'm in. So, you know, that's like my full-time job, and I'm still doing the real estate on the side, and just showed a house tonight, as a matter of fact. So, but I love the job. I mean, it's very interesting. It's selling, you know, what do I do best? You know, I sell myself. What do you do? What do wrestlers do? They sell themselves, and that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Anybody who's successful in the wrestling business can sell anything, pretty much.
Absolutely. So. And I say all the time. And the skills that you learn in the wrestling business can transition you into a career outside, you know, no question.
Do you ever foresee yourself doing anything else in the wrestling business, or are you happy to, are you content that this
is? I think you may see something in the very near future, but, you know, we'll just leave it at that.
A tease. Something in the very near future. Care to elaborate? Could we get a little bit more of a tease?
Not very near future, but near future. Nah, we'll just leave it at that, you know, because you never know, something could change in my life or so, and then that wouldn't come to fruition, so... when it happens, you'll know.
It'll be
out there.
We got something to look forward to. A little tease, always like a tease to end the show. All right, I appreciate you telling your story. Before we let you go, we want to bring on Shark Boy and have you play a 2017-2018 round of "What Would Stone Cold Steve Austin Say About ... So, are you game for that?
Oh my God. Without question.
He told the story last week about how the whole Stone Cold.
I heard it, so I went and listened to it, and he did it some justice. Not the justice that I would do it, but he definitely did some justice. No question. And Shark's a great guy. Greatest tour I was ever on was that India tour.
Even better than the Texas tour with the XWF with the bar.
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Yes, and we're going to talk about it for a couple minutes before we do the "What Would Stone Cold Say."
All right, we got Shark Boy back on with Simon Diamond, and we're going to let Simon Diamond roll with this one and talk a little bit about how this came to be, and then and do a little 2017-18 version of the game they played in India that led to this gimmick. So take it away, Simon.
So we go, it was me, Shark, and Sanjay. God bless Sanjay, because he had to put up with me and Shark, who were under the influence of alcohol probably 75% of the time. So we were there for 2 weeks.
Sounds about right.
And our itinerary every day was either get in a vehicle of some kind, be driven around by some maniac for hours to the next town where you would have media the next day or a show. And the media was, okay, guys, we're going to be talking to the local newspaper at 10 o'clock. So you would get dressed up in your gimmick in your room, and then you get a call at about 10 of 10. the guy who was our chaperone, we had stolen a cowboy hat from the first night at the outdoor facility that we were at, that we had the show, and we stole a cowboy hat. We put the cowboy hat on him, and I think, Shark, you were the one who called him the Colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was
like Elvis's manager. Yeah.
So he was the Colonel, and he would call us, and he'd be like, and he would call me Professor. Professor, we have a problem. It's now going to be a media call 11 o'clock. I was like, all right, Vicky, see you 11 o'clock. And then at 5 of 11, you get a call. It's 11:30 now. And it would keep getting pushed back. Now, I am a stickler for time, an absolute stickler, because when I played baseball at VCU, Coach Cozzo was a stickler for time. Never. And if you were late, that was disrespectful to the rest of the team, and you were
thinking about yourself above the team. And if you thought that way, you would never be able to play baseball in BC. That was his whole pitch. So, and I start telling the story to people around me because I'm starting to get aggravated, at which time Shark starts doing his, Shark and I are talking about, you know, who we watched as kids and who influenced us. Mostly because the first time when you're like on a tour with someone who you, are friendly with, but don't really know you, you begin to dig deeper into their life. And that's what we were doing with each other. And of course, you know, I was Flair and Superstar Billy Graham and Grand Wizard Tully Blanchard. And then Shark started talking about Stone Cold Steve Austin and just stops on a dime and hits the impression dead on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, you have to start talking like that in all your interviews and they'll yeah. never know the difference.
Right. So, we're in India. They wouldn't know. How would they know? Yeah.
Yeah. So me and Shark would be sitting, now picture this, in a hotel room, me, Shark, and Sanjay Dutt, dressed in our gimmicks, by the way, all sitting in the hotel room, and like three or four media people, and our handler and his friend, the guy with the glasses, I can't remember his name, in the room.
Yeah.
So, like eight people in these rooms, and they're, you know, we're just sitting there, and then, you know, they would turn to Shark, and they'd start talking to him, and he would cut the Stone Cold Steve Austin promo, and I would just sit there and giggle like a 7-year-old, and just found it so entertaining. So then, and then, I mean, every night we were, Shark and I were drinking every night, and oh by the way, none of this, we don't have to pay for a dime. It's all on the arm.
Yeah.
That's right. Everyone's picking up the tab, not us. So that's just all the more reason. I mean, mm-hmm. Remember the first night we ate at the three different restaurants in the hotel? Remember they had all those different
yeah.
restaurants and we're like, well, where do you want to eat? Like, I don't know. Well, let's go to all of them. We ain't paying. Typical restaurants.
Right.
So we
pumped that well.
It was just and then the night when the media showed up late and Vicky came in and he's like, Sanjay's asleep and I think Shark's too drunk. He doesn't want to put the mask on. And I was like, where is everybody? So I take my shirt off and I go chasing the media with the trash can. You know, I do
the
story gimmick. And everyone's,
that's right.
You know, they're loving it. They're taking pictures and I'm chasing everybody. And, but you know, it was just, but hands down, Shark, yes or no, the best tour ever.
The best ever. I had so much fun. I mean, we were there for 2 weeks. I didn't want to come home. It was awesome. You
remember
know?
Remember the day we were sitting in the dressing room and you said, what do you miss the most from home? And I go, pizza, really good pizza.
Yeah.
And 20 minutes later, the guy walks in with 10 different pizzas.
Pizza Hut. Yeah.
So, so is this for an indie promotion in India?
No, it was TNA. Yeah. Wasn't it for Sky Sports?
Yes, it was the debut of TNA on, ESPN Star.
Was it ESPN? Yeah, ESPN Star. That's what it was. Yep.
ESPN Star, which was the affiliate, ESPN affiliate.
So it was just media for 2 weeks?
Yeah.
It was media when we did these shows like Bollywood where we would, I'd come out, I'd bust through this like this cardboard wall. A Shark would come out underneath these dancers, you know, and they'd have this sheet and they'd make it look like water. Sanjay would come out in the full Bollywood gimmick. And then at the end, Shark and Sanjay would be thanking everybody. And then I'd come out, whoa, 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 Simon has a problem. And then we'd get into a little thing and we'd put Sanjay
with the hero at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And Sanjay would dance around with the flag of India. And
mm-hmm.
Everyone would go home happy. And then
we'd
put our stolen bathrobes from the hotel on and get coupled by about 12 security guards into a van. And we'd leave and mass, you know, 4,000 people surrounded the van. And we'd go back to the hotel and we'd start drinking Kingfisher.
That's it.
And
every morning it was like, hey, Pat, I'm not going to drink tonight. Are you? No, man, no. And then we.
It sounds like my life, but that's a totally different story.
Right.
So without further ado, let's play a little game, Simon, Pat Kenny, a little game of what would Stone Cold Steve Austin say about you could, you know, you go take it from there.
Okay. Well, What would Stone Cold Steve Austin say about the current state of TNA wrestling?
Well, I'll tell you this much. The wrestling business, it needs more than one place to work. The more places, the better. I wish nothing but the best for TNA wrestling. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you could line them boys up and one at a time, old Stone Cold will whip each and every one of their asses. And that's the bottom line.
What would Stone Cold Steve Austin say about Hillary Clinton?
Well, Hillary Clinton, I'll tell you what, old Stone Cold wasn't rooting for Donald Trump to win that election, but the only thing that would have been worse is if that piece of trash Hillary Clinton had gone in the White House.
What would Stone Cold Steve Austin say about Harvey Weinstein?
Harvey Weinstein. If Harvey Weinstein was a step up to old Stone Cold and trying to play grab ass, I would open up a can of whip ass on his fat ass so fast, it'd make his fucking head spin. Oh, I said that. Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
Drop the F-bomb.
It's okay. It's a podcast. Go on.
All right, man. All right.
What would Stone Cold Steve Austin say about the younger generation of wrestlers breaking kayfabe on social media?
Well, it's complete disrespect. Old Stone Cold was taught better than that. Simon Diamond, you were taught better than that. If these kids want to learn the hard way, old Stone Cold will damn sure be glad to show them the way we was taught. You have respect for this business. You have respect for your fellow wrestlers. If they want to break kayfabe and make what we do look like a big circus, then old Stone Cold will treat them like a bunch of jackasses.
What would old Stone Cold say about the 30 for 30 on Ric Flair that aired the other night?
That was damn good. It was real damn good. He always says a roller coaster of emotions when you're watching that thing. Old Stone Cold was impressed. Ric Flair might be the greatest pro wrestler of all time, with the exception of old Stone Cold.
What would old Stone Cold say about Dave Penzer?
Dave Penzer, pencil neck piece of trash. I can't even believe that I picked up the phone when I saw his number. I thought I had this number blocked, but now old Stone Cold's on the Dave Penzer show. And, you know, that's about all I got to say about Dave Penzer.
All right. One more. I got a question to ask. What would Stone Cold Steve Austin say about Donald Trump as president of the United States?
Donald Trump. Yeah, he likes to come out there and wear that power tie. Old Stone Cold's got a power finger, and I think you know which one I'm talking about. I don't care if he's worth $5 billion, $6 billion, $7 billion, $8 billion. Old Stone Cold would open up a $8 billion can of whoop-ass, and that's the bottom line.
So entertaining. So interesting.
Thank you.
It got us through the tour, didn't it?
Absolutely. And I miss the tapings that followed, running up to everybody going, "Hey, old Stone Cold, come here."
Yeah.
Hey, say what you
running that.
You know, you say that about Donald Trump. Say what you will about Donald Trump. My favorite thing that's happened since he became president was a picture of all the McMahons and all their kids in the Oval Office with the caption on social media like, two-thirds of these people have been stunned by Stone Cold Steve Austin, including the president of the United States.
Right. That was a great angle too. When they did it with Trump, I love that angle. That was fantastic.
I talked to Bobby Lashley about that. He had some very interesting, very very positive things to say about Trump, about what Trump did for him. So it was interesting.
Wow.
I'd love to hear what he thinks about him now.
Lashley thinks about Trump?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I'll try to have him on this podcast and ask him. All right, guys. Hey, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Shark.
Get a lot of interest in last week's podcast with Shark, and I'm sure there's going to be with this week. And Pat, thank you very much. Best of luck. And we'll be looking to see where you turn up. Now you got me a little bit curious. So, but thank you guys for coming on. I appreciate it. Well, I hope you had fun with that as I did as well. And as you listen to this, we will know who has won the bet and who has lost the bet. And So either way, we'll be back on this very podcast and somebody will be singing the other college's song. So we'll see. Crossing my fingers and saying my prayers, taking my vitamins for the Hurricanes. Want to thank Simon Diamond. Want to thank Shark Boy for coming on again. A quick cameo. And I want to thank Mike Freeland as well for interesting conversation. Next week, the one and only Don West is going to be here. And I am excited about that. If you think that the stories that that Pat Kenny, Simon Diamond told were interesting and entertaining, Don West is one of the best storytellers I've ever been able to be around. So it should be a blast. And we hope to have you come back and join us again. Any commentary on the show, at David Penzer on Twitter or at Penzer Ringside. Ladies and gentlemen, be sure to subscribe if you haven't already. And we're looking for just some more fun. Like to have fun and hope you are too. So until next time, until next week, when we're here with one of my good friends, Don West. I can't wait. We'll still be sitting ringside. You guys have a good week. Take care.
Follow David Penzer on Twitter at David Penzer. Also, make sure to follow the show on Twitter at Penzer Ringside. You've been sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence.
Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sports scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Kershaw, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.